Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today on the program, assessing the results of the COP26 climate conference and charting the way forward. Did Joe Biden succeed in reasserting American leadership in the fight against global warming? The president of the conference in Glasgow admitted that the final agreement did not meet the goals of the Paris Accord. Was this yet another example of the triumph of politics over progress? I'll talk about it with May Boovy, the co-founder and executive director of the environmental advocacy group 350.org. Plus, Midday on poetry. The poet and spoken word artist Kandwani Fidel and Maryland's poet laureate Grace Cavalieri share some of their recent work. That's all coming up on Midday after the news. Hey, everybody, welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. The COP26 UN Conference on Climate Change ended 10 days ago with deep divisions between some of the world's largest contributors to global warming still intact. President Joe Biden tried to reassert American leadership on climate, and following his return from Scotland, the House passed his infrastructure bill, which has $47 billion in environmental funding, including money to help clean up the Chesapeake Bay and to deal with the effects of climate change. That alone is the largest spending package on environmental provisions in American history. And days later, the House sent a much larger package to the Senate that at the moment contains more than $550 billion in climate provisions. Joining me to discuss the COP26 conference and the way forward is May Boovy. She's the co-founder and executive director of the environmental advocacy group 350.org. She joins us on Zoom from Oakland, California. May, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
So what marks do you give the conference? What do you think? I mean, what were some of the key highlights for you?
Well, I think there's a helpful analogy here, which I'm borrowing from a great climate journalist named David Roberts, which is that the COP is like a flash on a camera. It illuminates everything else that's going on around us at any time. So many people were following climate change in the news because of the existence of this summit. And that is really, really important because this is a problem that is affecting a lot of people here and now, but still for others feels like a faraway threat. And so for the 2 weeks that the COP happens, it's all eyes on the climate crisis. And that is really important. So I want to start by saying that. It's also really crucial for everyone listening to understand that we are very much in the 11th hour of this crisis. And so the requirements for action from governments, from corporations, from cities are very, very high. And in order to actually meet the goal that scientists have put forward for us, which is to keep warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, we've already warmed the world 1 degree. So there's not a lot of margin for error here. And that's why the stakes are always really, really high for these summits. And so having said all that, it's disappointing that world leaders are still not able to agree on reductions that would put both the science and the needs of global equity front and center in these talks. But there were some positive developments. And those are the direct result of pressure exerted by social movements. So for the first time ever in 26 years of these negotiations, fossil fuels were actually mentioned in the agreement. And that might seem crazy, but that's a big deal. And that means we can hold accountable governments for building new fossil fuel projects, which cause climate change.
And that's a key point that some folks have made about the obsession or the focus on coal, because for coal economies for in some of the underdeveloped countries around the world, it puts them at a disadvantage if other richer economies can shift from coal to some other fossil fuel. So the idea that all fossil fuels eventually have to be done away with is really key, isn't it?
It is. And there is a way to do this equitably. And there is a way to do this that creates jobs and supports people who are already suffering from the impacts of climate change or suffering from living next to a coal plant or a fracking well. So this opportunity to move away from fossil fuels is just that. It presents a way to remake our economy. And I think everyone is aware that the way the global economy is working is not really benefiting working families. So here we have an opportunity to do better. And that's what the fossil fuel phase out represents. I think the reason that it's so difficult is that rich countries like our own have failed to leverage the financial resources that developing countries need for this transition, as well as for adapting to the impacts of climate change. And this sort of resourcing was promised back in 2015 in the Paris Agreement. And our country and many others have just not shown up with the resources. And that makes it hard to trust. That makes it hard for developing countries to believe us when we say, the U.S. is back. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, do you think that the world received President Biden's attempt to reassert American leadership on climate with some skepticism then?
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. And let's remember that this dynamic is not new, where the United States wants to be perceived as a global leader, but it is not putting our money where our mouth is. And there you can name any number of international agreements where the same pattern applies. But it's not like our colleagues in other parts of the world aren't reading the same newspapers that are giving them the real-time updates about whether or not we're passing climate legislation. Everybody knows that while Glasgow was going on, there wasn't yet a national policy on climate change. And that makes it hard to believe us when we say we want to lead. That said, I do think the Biden administration takes our international relationships very seriously. And I do think that the president has made it clear that he understands what an existential threat climate change is and what an opportunity dealing with it is for the rest of the things that are hallmarks of his agenda, like reducing poverty, creating a stronger economy, creating a much more healthy environment.
May Bouvy is a co-founder and executive director of 350.org. That's an environmental advocacy group based in California. She joins us on Zoom from Oakland. If you have a question for May Bouvy, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at @midday_WIPR. So May, when it comes to American policy regarding climate, what do you make of the infrastructure bill? There's $47 billion in that bill designated for climate resilience, so-called. And then, of course, the Build Back Better plan, which the House passed a few days after it passed the infrastructure bill, is now sitting in the Senate, and who knows what it'll finally end up being. But there is a proposal, at least, for $555 billion for climate change programs. I mean, both of these initiatives, far and away the most that the United States has ever spent on it. How would you assess its potential efficacy, and where does it fit into the movement for climate justice as we speak?
I think it's very, very important. And once I talk about the efficacy, I want to talk about what people listening can do. But $555 billion would easily make the Build Back Better bill the largest climate change policy in our country's history. And there's a lot of aspects of it that are meant to do exactly what I've been talking about, to really invest in the economy of the future. And it's not going to, on its own, meet our pledge, which is that we would have our emissions from 2005 levels by 2030, but it would get us about one third of the way toward that target. And that is really important, because every degree matters when we're talking about climate change. So that's very important. The centerpiece is really about investing in clean energy. And that includes people who want to switch to an electric vehicle or a hybrid car, or who want to put solar panels on their school or their church, and really making it easier for consumers to participate in the clean energy revolution. So that is a very powerful aspect of it. However, we need to see far more done on the other side of the ledger, which is what we refer to as the supply side problem. We're still investing far too much in coal, oil, and gas. In fact, the Biden administration just participated in a lease of offshore oil and gas permits right after Glasgow ended, which was not a good look. And so we've got to be addressing the problem and the solution at the same time. So there is absolutely more we have to do, but this would move us well on our way. I also want to mention that let's think about the Build Back Better bill, not just in these specific clean energy elements per se, but also the provisions around healthcare, around paid family leave. These aspects relate to climate change as well, because creating a stronger social safety net for working families builds more resilient communities. And the research shows that the single greatest way to protect yourself from a climate disaster is to have a community to support you. Republicans have starved public programs for years, and it has had the impact of weakening community support systems. So all of those other provisions actually relate to how we deal with climate change. And I think that's really important for everyone to understand. And if you're listening, please do what you can to get involved, to advocate that we get this piece of crucial legislation through, because what we each do as individuals to call our legislators and call our senators impacts all of the things we've been talking about, even all the way up to a global climate agreement.
You mentioned the internal politics here in the U.S. What about global politics? The U.K. Minister of State, who was the president of the Glasgow conference, Alok Sharma, said that the final agreement, he had to admit that the final agreement did not meet the goals of the Paris Accords in terms of reducing the temperature 1.5 degrees Celsius. So what does that admission say about the political climate globally? Did the needle move at all in your estimation? And what do you think it will take for the needle to move further moving forward?
So the needle moves in the sense that some crucial rules were agreed that mean that there have to be more reports about how countries are doing in tackling climate change. And that matters because for campaigning organizations like 350.org, we are looking for opportunities to push governments to be more ambitious. So that is made possible because of these new rules. And agreeing to rules is the definition of moving the needle, but processes matter when it comes to politics. So that is important to acknowledge. And this was an important COP. Once every 5 years, there's a kind of super COP where countries meet and update their plans. And that's important, but it's not the only process. And there are many other ways countries can update what they're doing. I want to remind listeners that 197 countries around the world participate in the UN Climate Summit Agreement. And they all work by consensus. And I want to try to let that sink in for a second about just how difficult that is for all the different conditions in all those countries, for everyone to agree by consensus to what is in that text. Try to imagine that in your own community. It's not easy. And so that is what they're trying to do, but that is also the power of what they've done. And in terms of how do we make this better and how do we move the needle, it relates to what we were just talking about. If the United States and every single country has an aggressive climate plan, that means we can show up at global summits ready to negotiate and be trusted. And so if we are able to call our senators, if we are able to organize our communities to do everything possible to address climate and inequality, we are doing our part, not only at the local level, but the global level as well.
Let's go to the phones. We have a caller, Jonas, on the line from Baltimore. Welcome to the program with May Bouvy.
Thank you. So my question is about vehicle electrification. You know, we hear all the time automakers marketing now electric vehicles. But, you know, my question is, how feasible is this really? I mean, you know, gasoline-powered vehicles are still in the majority, the vast majority, and electric vehicles are really expensive. And if there's anything we've realized during COVID, it's that used cars work really well and we can use them for a long time, like they do in Europe. I mean, here we lease and, you know, we change our vehicles every couple of years, but unless there's a significant government subsidy and incentive to purchase an electric vehicle, I frankly don't know anyone who's gonna buy one unless they're, you know, pretty upper middle class. Just your thoughts on that.
All right, thanks. And there is a subsidy in the Build Back Better plan, as well as $1 billion, I believe it is, to build charging stations, and then also to improve. There's even more money to improve the electric grid. But Maybhuvi, what about the cost of these vehicles in the short term?
Yeah, Tom, you took the words right out of my mouth. It will get better if we pass certain policies. And let's remember, the fossil fuel industry is heavily subsidized, and that's the only reason why it seems easier to use the existing fuel sources rather than moving to electric. So it will only get better if we can create more incentives. But I want to pick up on something that you said, Jonah, because we do still consume far too much. Certainly relative to other countries and relative to what we can actually practically manage. And there's been an effort, I think, to make it seem as if adjusting to the climate crisis is going to be easy, is going to be good for business. But we do have to look hard at some of the changes that have to be made. And so just replacing all the fossil fuel infrastructure with clean energy infrastructure, we're already starting to see news about the impact of mining for the metals required to build clean energy infrastructure. So there are still costs that have to be paid. But in terms of the feasibility, it's 100% there. And this is part of why many of us feel optimistic, because it is possible to electrify everything, as many people say, and it will make a tremendous difference in terms of climate change impacts.
Maybhuvi is the co-founder and executive director of 350.org. That's an environmental advocacy group based in California. May, thank you for your time. Appreciate it. And hope we can talk again and stay current with what's going on in the fight for climate justice.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to switch gears for Midday on Poetry. The spoken word artist and writer Kandwani Fidel joins me after a quick break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.